This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Rick Scott signed a bill crafted to get Florida's death penalty back on track after a year in limbo. Murder trials were put on hold after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Florida's death penalty unconstitutional. The bill signed by the governor requires a unanimous jury recommendation for a death sentence. So does this new law mean executions will resume immediately? And now the Orange Osceola state attorney has come out saying she will not seek the death penalty. What does all this mean for opponents of capital punishment and those who say it delivers justice for the families of murder victims? We're joined by a panel of experts and we're taking your calls. 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. We're also on Twitter. You can find us at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio, Charlie Wells. He's a former Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice. He's an off-counsel attorney at Gray Robinson. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Also joined by Stephen Lawrence, defense attorney in Orlando and an expert on the death penalty. Stephen Lawrence, thank you so much for coming in.
You're more than welcome.
And with us from Tallahassee, Democratic State Senator Randolph Bracey. He sponsored the bill to fix the Florida death penalty. Thank you for joining us, Senator Bracey.
No problem. Thank you.
And our phones are open, 1-866-338-5252. First, Orange Osceola County State Attorney Aramis Ayala says she won't pursue the death penalty for Markeith Lloyd or other cases handled by her office. Lloyd's accused of murdering his pregnant ex-girlfriend Sade Dixon and Orlando Police Lieutenant Deborah Clayton. OPD Chief Police Chief John Mina says he's extremely upset with that decision. Governor Scott has removed Ayala from that Markeith Lloyd case now and reassigned the case. But Ayala said in the news conference that she came to the decision after considering Florida's death penalty statute. She said the death penalty in Florida was, quote, an inconsistent system. Here she is at the press conference yesterday.
Florida's death penalty has been the cause of considerable legal chaos, uncertainty, and turmoil. An analysis of death penalty must be pragmatic. It must be realistic and not simply theoretical, impulsive, or emotional.
That's Orange Osceola County State Attorney Aramis Ayala explaining her decision not to seek the death penalty in cases prosecuted in her jurisdiction. Senator Randolph Bracey, I want to start with you. What's your response to that decision by Ayala? Does it suggest there's still some work to do on the death penalty in Florida?
There is work to be done. The death penalty is unevenly applied, and research shows that depending on which circuit you're in, more or less likely will determine if you're to get the death penalty or not. So I think the legislature does need to look at our death penalty scheme and find ways to make it better. There was a number of issues that were brought up during the legislative session about the death penalty. One of them was aggravating factors. It only takes one aggravating factor to send someone to the death penalty. And we have, I think, over 20 aggravating factors to choose from. So, you know, if a state attorney wants to send someone to death, it's fairly easy to find something to send them to death for. So mm-hmm. we just need to look at our death penalty scheme and make it better if that's what we're going to do in this state.
What about your reaction to Governor Scott removing Aramis Ayala from the Markeith Lloyd case? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, he definitely has the authority to do that, but I think that whether you agree with the state attorney's decision or not, she does have the discretion to do what she did, and so she didn't act unlawfully, mm-hmm. but the governor certainly, I guess, had the authority to do that.
Now, coming back to the bill which you sponsored, I mean, walk us through it. Is it enough for Florida to now resume carrying out executions?
It is. The only thing that the Florida Supreme Court required of the legislature was to require a unanimous verdict when sending someone to death. And so we fixed that. And so now it meets constitutional muster, and pending cases can now move forward.
I wonder, though, I mean, if you think there are still issues with the death penalty and it does need another look, what was your rationale for sponsoring this bill to get things back on track?
Well, one, I'm the criminal justice chairman in the Senate, so the Senate president asked me, being the leader on criminal justice issues in the Senate, to sponsor the bill. That was one reason. And so, you know, my thinking was, listen, you know, the will of the legislature was to have the death penalty in Florida. Mm-hmm. So whether I agree with it or not, I decided to take the lead to at least make it a little bit better. And I thought unanimity makes it better. And so that's why I decided to sponsor it.
Senator Randolph Bracey, we're talking about the death penalty in Florida, the latest on that, specifically what's going on here in Orange, Osceola County, with RMS Ayala saying she's not going to prosecute death penalty cases. She won't seek the death penalty in capital cases in her jurisdiction. Former Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, Charlie Wells, I want to bring you in on this conversation. And just first, your reaction to what happened yesterday with RMS Ayala saying she's not going to prosecute, or she's not going to seek the death penalty, and then being taken off that case. Things moving pretty quickly there. Have you ever seen anything like this?
I have not. I think that that's, at least in my experience, in being a lawyer in Florida for over 50 years, I have followed what state attorneys around Florida have done, and I did not remember a situation in which there has been a pre-announcement by a prosecutor that a particular charge was not going to be brought within his or her jurisdiction. So I think that's we're plowing new ground here.
Do you see other state's attorneys following that lead?
I don't know. I think that it's certainly, as Senator Bracey said, it's the prerogative of the state's attorney to make decisions mm-hmm. as to charges. But I think that the usual situation should be and has been that those decisions are made on a case-by-case basis and not on the basis that an announcement that a particular charge that's available under Florida law is not going to be brought. And I think that's I have questions about doing that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the question I had looking at that was, what will happen next time there's a case like this if Prosecutor Ayala decides to take herself, says she won't seek the death penalty? Is Governor Scott going to have to step in every time and remove her from that case?
Well, I think that as I said, we are in plowing new ground here, and so those decisions have not been made by a prior governor, and to my knowledge, and so we'll have to see. But it seems like that the governor is intent upon doing that.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the bill that was signed into law by the governor, the Supreme Court decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision that put the brakes on the death penalty in Florida last year, applies to cases after 2002. So what about cases that predate that? Seems like there might be some things to sort out there.
Well, there are several issues which will be presented in those cases that were pre-Ring versus Arizona and had gotten to finality before the issue of the unanimity came to the fore by the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Arizona case. And so we're going to have to take those cases under the recent decision of the Florida Supreme Court on a case-by-case basis and see whether those defendants are going to, in fact, be executed.
We're talking about the death penalty in Florida. We're at 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts on the bill that was signed recently by Governor Rick Scott, which means that there needs to be a unanimous jury decision for a death sentence? And what about the opponents to the very idea of the death penalty? And what are your thoughts on RMS Ayala, the prosecutor for Orange, Osceola County, stepping in and saying she is not going to seek the death penalty in cases in her jurisdiction? Stephen Lawrence, defense attorney in the Orlando area, I want to bring you on this conversation. RMS Ayala described the death penalty as the cause of chaos, uncertainty, and turmoil. What's your take on that? As a defense attorney, is she right?
She is right. It is inconsistently applied from circuit to circuit. It is inconsistently applied. It involves a lot of factors, including race, including economics. There are a lot of factors that go into a particular case as to whether or not a person gets a death penalty or doesn't get the death penalty that just simply are not consistent. It has been inconsistently applied since its inception.
And I will point out that you've just come from a conference talking about this very issue. What are some of the things up for discussion? Has the Ayala situation come up yet?
Well, it certainly was a hot topic yesterday. The first issue I think that is presented is, does she have the authority to make that decision? And I think that she does. I think the courts have consistently held that the prosecutor has the right to make a decision in a potential capital case as to whether or not to proceed either with death or without death. Now, what Mr. Chief Justice was talking about was the first time that someone has, not in a single case, but in a grouping of cases that have yet to come, has made that decision, which makes this extremely unique, and I would agree with you about that. But I thought it was bold, and actually I applaud her for it, because I think as criminal defense lawyers, we believe the death penalty should go away. And I think that recognition by a prosecuting attorney in the state of Florida is certainly good news.
What about folks, though, who say, look, this is we need justice for our, you know, for our loved ones, and this is the only way we're going to get it?
Well, for those people, I would tell you, go to Rayford, go to a 6x6 cell, and go stay in it for 40 or 50 years. It is extreme punishment. Now, maybe they're not going to lose their life, but being confined to a cell, 6x6 cell, for the rest of your life is certainly punishment. I have had a number of clients that would tell you that that's the worst. It's more of a punishment than death.
We're at 1-866-338-5252, talking about the death penalty in Florida. The latest on that, executions could be in effect again in Florida with this new bill. Stephen Lawrence, how hard is it to get a unanimous verdict on anything? I mean, does the new rule make your job any easier?
Well, I think it is more difficult, and I believe the senator was absolutely correct about that. If we're going to have what I perceive to be a bad law, the death penalty, then let's at least make it unanimous. It has never made sense to me that we could convict somebody of a crime, and to convict them, the jury had to return a unanimous verdict, but you could kill them with less than a unanimous verdict. That just made no sense at all. And just so you know, to give you an illustration, just since Ring versus Arizona, which was in 2002 till now, there will be roughly 150 different persons who will come back for resentencings because there was not a unanimous verdict. So obviously it makes it much more difficult.
Randolph Bracey, Senator Bracey, what are your thoughts on this idea that the law maybe gives a little to both sides? It preserves the death penalty, but it could result in fewer death sentences due to making it more difficult to get a unanimous jury.
That may be the case. I wouldn't argue against that point. But again, I mean, death is the highest punishment that we could give out. And so if we're going to do it, I think that it should not be easy to send someone to death. I think we should have a unanimous verdict and sending someone to death. So it may be more difficult, but I think it's necessary.
What about the perspective of the families of the victims of murder? Has there been much pressure from those families, victims' families, over the last year to get executions rolling again?
Not to my knowledge. You know, one of the points that was brought up was that by Airman Sayala is that these cases take a very long time. You know, when they go through the process of running through the appeals, I mean, it takes sometimes 20, 25 years. And so, so it doesn't necessarily provide closure. So to answer your question, I have not heard of families that have asked for a rush to implement the death penalty.
Former Chief Justice Charlie Wells, your thoughts on that? I mean, is a death sentence in effect a life sentence?
Well, it has turned out to be an extreme punishment under Florida law because of the length of time that we are confining the people who have been convicted of the death penalty on death row. And I have long considered that the incarceration period in such a restrictive confinement reaches the level of cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the key problems with the administration of the death penalty in Florida.
Going to take a couple of calls here. We've got somebody calling in from Kissimmee. Eric, I believe. Eric, you're on the air. What are your thoughts listening to this conversation?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say that I completely disagree with the prosecutor's decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if she was going to make this kind of blanket statement that she will not enforce the death penalty, which is the law in the state, then she should have said that before she got elected so the people that elected her could have taken that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she's doing it now is completely unacceptable. And I think that, honestly, you know, she should be recalled or something like that because, you know, how can she say that when the next heinous crime comes up, even worse than murdering a police officer, that she will not use all the tools available to her under the law? That's my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Eric. Appreciate that. Let's go to our other caller here. We've got Jim on the line from Orlando. Jim, what are your thoughts?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say the idea that living in a prison is in itself a sentence is true, but they become accustomed to that life. And you know, there's a point where they realize that that is their existence. You know, they can still have loved ones to visit with them. They can still participate in certain functions that a dead person can't. You know, when you go over somebody and you kill them, I mean, that's the ultimate crime, and there should be recompense for that. They should have to pay likewise.
So you're comfortable with the death penalty being applied in Florida? What are your thoughts on this bill? Are you happy that the mechanism's been put in place to get it rolling again?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a problem with it being a unanimous vote. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it is a heavy sentence to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly understand that there are cases where someone may have been wrongfully accused. So I don't have a problem that all the members of the jury have to come to that decision. I don't. But to say that you're not even going to offer it, I wonder, Ms. Ayala, what her, and I know this is going sideways, but I wonder what her opinion is on abortion then. You know, I mean, if she thinks that all life
right.
is special
that,
and, you know, we're doing
that is kind of a little off topic, but I do appreciate you calling in and weighing in on the death penalty. Thanks for your call, Jim. Just a quick thought there, Stephen Lawrence. This idea that, you know, it's a sentence being committed to the, you know, committed to prison or held in, you know, the kind of seclusion that the prisons are on death row, but it's better than the alternative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it is the ultimate form of confinement. It's hard to describe what someone who is on death row, and you have to not only realize that they're in prison, but they're on death row, and they have their own wing. They have very little contact with the outside world. They do occasionally have the right to see other people. But what I would say is this. You cannot bring the victims back.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you kill the person who killed your family member, it's not going to bring them back, and it's not going to give you total closure.
Stephen Lawrence, defense attorney in Orlando, thank you so much for joining us.
You are welcome. Thank
also
you.
Also joined by Charlie Wells, former Florida Supreme Court Justice. Thank you, Charlie Wells.
You.
And from Tallahassee, Democratic State Senator Randolph Bracey. Thank you so much, Senator Bracey.
You're welcome.
Up next, University of Central Florida President John Hitt has been at UCF for 25 years, watching the university almost triple in size. He joins us to talk about the challenges of running the second biggest public university in the country, including supporting foreign students and faculty affected by the White House's executive order on immigration. Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Immigration bans out of the White House had universities across the country scrambling with students and faculty in limbo. UCF President John Hitt says he stands by those students and faculty, and he worries about the chilling effect on foreign students who aren't affected by the order, but who might be reconsidering their studies here in the United States. Hitt sat down with us to talk about the executive order. He also talks about UCF's growth since he's been at the helm to now the second largest university in the country and the expansion to the new downtown campus in Orlando. Well, John Hitt is the president of the University of Central Florida. Last month, he celebrated 25 years at the university. His current contract runs until June. Dr. Hitt, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with your time at the helm. You've been there quite some time, a quarter century. How much longer would you like to remain president of UCF?
Well, as long as I can feel like I'm effective and the Board of Trustees wants me to do it, I'll probably do it.
It's a big job, right? I mean, the university has grown considerably since you first started. I think it was some 22,000 students when you first got there.
Just short of that, yes.
It's now almost tripled in size.
Mm-hmm.
Could you have predicted just how big the university would get when you started out here?
Matthew, I don't think I could have. I knew it would be a lot bigger than it was. Not that many months after I got here, I came upon a memo that said we would have, I think it was 48,000 students by 2000 or something like that. It probably wasn't 2000, probably 2010 or something. But at any rate, whatever the number was, it recalibrated my thinking. I said, my gosh, you know, this is pretty well done work. And, you know, when you're talking about something that happens in, say, 18 years, like a kid is born and goes to college, you can get pretty good prediction. Mm-hmm. And so that adjusted my mental processes a bit, and we started taking a little more seriously the thought that we would have to deal with 40,000-plus students.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at what's new at the university. And just last week, the groundbreaking for the new downtown campus was announced, May 11th, I understand. The project was beset by a couple of delays. Has it been frustrating seeing that project come to life and the delays in that?
Well, you know, you'd like every project to go as smoothly as you could envision, but they seldom do. And I think this, considering where it is, you know, downtown, apart from the main campus, the funding was a little complex. Depending for good neighbors in the city to come up with a third of the money, I think it's gone pretty well, and I feel good about it.
Was it important for you to stick around as president of the university to see that groundbreaking and to see the campus actually completed, if that's what happens?
Well, it would be nice, but there'll always be something. You know, in a university the size of UCF, there'll always be a project of some significance. So you just have to accept that when the time comes to go, you're going to go, because if you wait until there's not a significant project, you may go out feet first rather than in a walking manner.
Just remind us, too, whether this new campus is going to expand the student population or you're moving some of the courses from the current site to the downtown location.
At least initially, it will not significantly expand the enrollment. We don't intend to raise enrollment. We'll just move the existing programs to the downtown campus.
But it does give you some room to expand,
yes,
your footprint.
Absolutely. Back here on the main campus, we'll have quite a bit of square footage that we can repurpose, and that should be a real benefit for us in our existing programs.
Do you have some thoughts as to which programs might benefit from that added space?
Well, I don't want to name any personally because I'm not on top of that, and I was once in a situation where three different administrators promised the same space to three different departments, and I don't want to be part of an exercise like that. So I'll leave that to the fellows and gals that we've charged with signing the space.
John Hitt, it is quite a big move, though, right, for the university to come all the way downtown and have a presence there. And I'm wondering what you think it does for Paramore to have a university right on its doorstep.
A lot of the benefits, I think, will be indirect. By that, I mean, well, here's an example. Students in the Paramore area, as they're coming up, will have many opportunities to be on that campus, to be part of programs that will engage them, and to begin an association with a university campus with fun. with opportunities to learn, with great opportunities to meet other other students. So I think it, many of the benefits will be not so much I studied XYZ at UCF downtown, but gosh, I had a great time on the UCF downtown campus, and we learned some really great biology or chemistry or physics. I think that's the that's really what we're most likely to see in the early years.
It may be a little early days yet, but do you foresee some Paramore-specific scholarships, things like that? To
yes, get? Yes. I think Harris Rosen has promised that he would fund at the level of state university tuition any student who finished there and then went on. Is it Jones High School, I believe, that he's going to fund that? And we've said, for instance, Dr. German, the dean of our medical college, has said that any student who finishes at having come through Paramore, gone through Jones, if they finish with eligibility for a medical education, it'll be free.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a wonderful opportunity. Now, you got to remember, though, if all we do is say that, it probably won't have much of an impact because a lot of the students historically have not really had a real opportunity there, and they're going to be skeptical. So we're going to have to make it very clear that we're serious about this, that if they want to be a doctor and they're willing to work, they can have it for free. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have an obligation, I think, to make it clear to them that it'll be earned and that it's real. If they meet the criteria, they're going to get that education.
John Hood, I want to pivot now and pick up on talk of funding and fees. And I'm just wondering, too, what your take is on how Education Secretary Betsy DeVos might shape higher education in the next 4 years.
I've tried to figure out what I think the impact will be, and I can't right now. So I'm not sure what the secretary has to say to higher education at this point. So we'll stay tuned.
What would you like her to do?
Well, you know, the federal government has only about a 5% funding impact on higher education. So whatever she does, it's probably not going to be super dramatic in and of itself. If she could somehow find a way to start reversing the trend of substituting loans for grants, I would be thrilled. We've seen a really dramatic shift away from grants, Pell Grants, for instance, other federal grant programs, to loans. And we get this constant drumbeat about the tremendous loan burden that every student graduating from college has. Not true that they have that, but it is a deterrent to many students from low financial backgrounds. It deters them from looking at higher education. I would think if we could get more grant, less loan, we would do something really good.
Well, just picking up off of that then, late in his campaign last year, then-presidential candidate Donald Trump made some comments about student loans, and he said that the federal government should expect colleges to control costs, and if they don't invest resources in students, they'll be held accountable. Does that suggest to you that colleges might have to take another look at how they manage their finances?
Oh, I think some universities and colleges definitely should. We haven't raised tuition or fees at UCF in 4 years. To be absolutely candid, that's because Governor Scott has insisted that we not. But we found a way to live with it.
Would you like to, though? I mean, is that something you think the university needs to do?
Well, I think it's difficult to criticize holding costs down. At the same time, when you have no increase in tuition or fees for 4 years and your prices keep going up, well, there's an end in sight for that. We may not be there now, but there is an end in sight on it.
So when you look at state funding then, and particularly this year in the legislature, you have Florida Senate President Joe Negron. He's looking to boost funding for universities, expand Bright Futures scholarships, and put funding into helping universities attract top-level faculty and also support good grad school programs. And on the other hand, you have the House Appropriations Committee taking a hard look at university spending. Do you think universities like UCF could be looking at a funding boost?
Well, I think it's very clear that Mr. Negron would like to see a funding boost. He's made his priority very clear, and I think there's been some indication of what the the speaker's response will be. So we'll just have to see how that works out.
I want to turn now to President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration. And you said that the university stands with its foreign students and faculty, but you're also advising students and staff affected by the executive order on immigration not to travel outside of the United States for now. What else can you do to help those affected by this order?
Well, the best thing we can do at this point, I think most everybody who's impacted by it knows they may be impacted by it, is get them good legal counsel and try to make that available to them at a cost that they can bear or at no cost. Many of the international students that we have and that others have across the country have planned out very carefully what their budget will be. They're required to do that when they come to the U.S., but they don't have a lot of slack in that budget. So we want to be sure that the students that we brought to UCF to study and to impart knowledge of other cultures and civilizations to our students, we want to be really sure that they can meet the costs that are required there.
The proportion of students or faculty affected by this is pretty small.
Small at UCF, yes.
But what about the impact?
Well, the impact is substantial in many areas because when you have friends who are really upset, really worried, you know, they're worried about whether if they leave the country for any reason, can they come back? They're partway through a degree program. What happens to that? There are a lot of concerns that we have, and you know, just the angst that students go through when they're not sure that they'll be able to continue their education. They and their families have expended a lot of money to get them here, and things are going well. They're very happy. All of a sudden, they may not be eligible to remain.
So is the university helping provide some legal counsel at cost for those students or faculty?
As I understand it, our Student Government Association is doing that through funds that they their own funds that they collect.
And is there a ripple effect for students or people who are considering study in the United States who aren't on that ban but might just be thinking or reconsidering their plans to come and study here?
I've seen a couple of higher ed press reports suggesting that in the last week or so, that students are saying, gee, I don't know. I'm not sure I'll be able to really complete a degree. Is it wise for me to undertake one?
I'm wondering, too, if you've noticed anything in the way of, the climate at the university, like at UCF, for example. Have you heard any instances of bullying or people being picked on because of the kind of general climate at this point in time?
Really have not. Doesn't mean we couldn't or won't, but to my knowledge, we have not at this point.
And just sort of looking at this globally, I mean, what can you do as a president of a pretty big university to advocate for the rights of foreign students and faculty?
Well, I think first off, we can make it known that by our lights, the international students are a real plus. We don't have a student body composed of students who can afford to go abroad in big numbers, huge numbers. We'd like to send everybody abroad. Well, we know we can't do that, but we could bring more students in from other countries and give our students, our native U.S. students, an opportunity to learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a little bit of international travel, and I can tell you that periods as short as a week or two have made a real difference in my understanding of how life is lived in some parts of the world. So my sense is that we don't have to spend a huge amount of money. We don't have to bend any rules. We just need to have a good, solid program, and we can give the international students and our own U.S. students a really worthwhile experience working together.
I want to just come back to the size of the university now versus the size it was when you came onto the scene. And I'm wondering, does a bigger university necessarily mean a better university?
No, it doesn't, any more than a smaller university necessarily means a better university. You have to look at the programs. You have to look at the results and make your judgments there. It was interesting to me that in months past, we had the award of the performance-based funding. And once again, the institutions that got the awards were the largest. Now, I don't want to say that just because a place is large, it's not, you know, it's not good, or that it is good. I think you have to look at each program and see what they're doing and what the results are. Data are there's nothing quite like having some good data on student success. And if you focus on student success, you won't go too far wrong.
John Hitt is the president of the University of Central Florida. He just celebrated 25 years at the university. Dr. Hitt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on Intersection, harpist Christine McPhail joins us to perform some classics, including one of her favorite Van Morrison tracks. If you missed an episode of Intersection, you can download the podcast. You can also find us online, wmfe.org/intersection. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, harpist Christine McPhail performing Pachelbel's Canon. Listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Christine McPhail, performing Pachelbel's Canon in D on the harp. So, Christine, tell us about this. How did you get involved in harp playing?
When I was a little girl, I grew up in Western Canada. I was with my family at a museum and saw a small harp in there, and my father strummed the strings. And it was love at first sound, I guess. And I pestered my parents for a good 6 months, and they finally bought me a little Celtic harp and found a teacher, and that was that.
Okay, so you started on something a little more portable than what you're playing now.
That's correct, a small Celtic harp, just a few feet high.
And were you playing Celtic music? What kind of tunes did you start out with?
I started out with all classical music. I played classical music until I was in college, and then one of my roommates asked me to play for her wedding and wanted some love songs. So I learned those, and then as I became a professional musician, I just adapted to whatever my clients wanted, learned some Latin music, country music, just about everything that you could play on a piano, I could play on the harp.
And do you play some country music on this full-size harp?
I do. I had Father of the Groom the other day ask me for Rocky Top, so just about anything works.
Wow. Now, do you perform with an orchestra as well?
No, probably 95% of my work is weddings, and then a little bit of corporate as well.
Is it something that it's kind of easy to maneuver around? Tell me about being a harpist. What's it like playing one of these?
Much easier than it looks. It's not that heavy. This harp's about 50 pounds, and this is about a mid-size harp. Mm-hmm. I have a dolly, sort of like a Home Depot hand truck, and so I can wheel it around everywhere. Stairs are a little tricky, but I know where all the ramps and all the elevators are in town. It's not too hard.
Well, Christine McPhail, you've got some other tunes you'd like to play. Tell us about the next one.
Well, I grew up in the 70s. I'm just a huge fan of 70s music. And I thought I'd play for you my favorite song of all time, Moondance by Van Morrison.
All right.
¶¶
Christine McPhail with Moondance by Van Morrison. Christine, is that a popular choice for weddings as well?
Not too much nowadays.
Right.
It was back in the day, but not so much nowadays. But I have it on my website, so sometimes the young girls will see it and they'll like it. So.
Uh-huh. Are there some other 70s tunes you've adapted for harp?
Oh, pretty much anything. Eagles, Jimmy Buffett, Billy Joel, Elton John, everything
right.
I grew up with.
What about contemporary music?
Yes, I try to keep up with all the new love songs, and most of the brides usually want something, you know, within the last few years, sort of like their first dance song, something similar to that.
And aside from the Pachelbel's Canon you played earlier, what are the standouts, like what are the popular requests you get?
Well, I don't play Here Comes the Bride too much anymore. There's Pachelbel's Canon, the Wedding March for when the couples walk back out, their recessional. Some other classical, maybe Bach Jesu or Trumpet Voluntary, and then love songs other than that.
Do you have to be in relatively good shape and do you sort of develop some real finger strength playing it?
Yes, definitely have to keep shoulders and arms in good shape. I have to keep my fingernails short. I guess moving it as well is also pretty physical, putting it in the car. I forgot to mention that earlier. I have to shop for a vehicle that the harp will fit in every time I need a new car as well. So.
Right. And then you've got there's a couple of pedals on the bottom of it too. What are those for?
Oh, that's correct. The pedals are for sharps and flats. And so each string could be three different pitches, and the pedals move discs on the harp to change the pitch of the string.
And in Florida, is it difficult to keep this in tune just with the humidity?
Oh, I gave that up long ago.
Oh, really?
Yes, it is pretty difficult, especially when you're coming from air-conditioned home to car, outside, maybe then into a building. And so there's three different materials that the strings are made out of, and each one's might stretch at a different rate as well. And so I try to tune up before I start any job.
Now, do you still play the Celtic harp as well, the smaller one you started out on?
No, I don't have that anymore, unfortunately. I'll have to... They're very good for playing on the beach. So right now I don't play any jobs on the beach because this harp is hollow at the bottom.
Right.
But the small Celtic harps have legs, and so they're great for the beach. So maybe I'll look into getting one.
Yeah, imagine getting sand inside your harp probably wouldn't be the best thing for it.
I'm pretty flexible about everything except sand.
Right.
A little bit of sun, you know, a few little bit of drizzle of rain. It's not great for the harp, but I'm pretty flexible on all of that. But sand is just impossible.
Do you get a lot of requests for beach weddings, though?
Fairly often, yeah. In Florida, a couple of the other harpists have Celtic harps, so I refer to them.
Well, Christine McPhail, tell us about the last tune you're going to play.
This is one of the love songs I mentioned, a little more contemporary. It's a few years old now, but it's been very popular for weddings. It's Christina Perry's A Thousand Years.
Thank you.
Christine McPhail, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brandon Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Creston. Amy Green answered the phones. Our intern is Talia Blake. If you missed an episode, subscribe to our podcast or check out our website. We're now more than halfway through our silent drive and we need a little help to make it a success. You can show your support for Intersection and other local programming on 90.7 with a gift at wmfe.org/support or by calling 1-800-785-2020. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.